This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Extreme weather whiplash is coming as we warm the world. Malte Stucker found El Nino and La Nina get stronger and links up with other big ocean systems like the North Atlantic and Indian Oceans. The result is climate-driven weather whiplash from severe drought to extreme rain and floods year to year in a predictable seesaw of disasters. Next story, over 50,000 Europeans died due to excess heat in 2023 and 2024. Even wealthy countries can't adapt, and it's going to get worse. Dr. Christopher Callahan with latest findings on heat deaths in Europe. Finally, hourly temperatures reveal a week less winter and over a week more heat stress in parts of America, distinguished Professor Sandra Uter explains. Three breaking science interviews this week on Radio EcoShock. Let's go.
Thunder before the apocalypse, long future, calling in, consumer soldiers, merchants of waste, disappearing, green, watching storm makers, heat fakers, life takers, empty out everything.
What if extreme weather systems across all oceans start working together? We find that strange new future in a study in Nature Communications. The title is Global Climate Mode Resonance Due to Rapidly Intensifying El Niño Southern Oscillation. We reached the lead author, well-published climate meteorologist Malte Stucker. Malte heads or is part of several research institutes at the University of Hawaii. From Honolulu, Malte Stucker, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
It is hard to imagine these large systems going from the ocean to the atmosphere. Here on land, we just experience weather systems, extremes in some years and not others. How should we picture these mechanisms, Malte, as the atmospheric events, or are they changes in the ocean? What are they?
These very large climate patterns, you know, that El Nino and La Nina, for instance, are part of, are really characterized by changes in the ocean currents and global wind patterns that occur together. So it's really the ocean and the atmosphere changing together. So in contrast, when we refer to our daily weather, the geographical extent is much smaller and the typical duration of events is relatively short. So importantly, the large climate patterns shift how likely specific weather patterns that we experience on a daily basis are in a given year.
So let's talk about major weather makers. We pretty well know about El Nino and La Nina, known as ENSO. But even people living along the Atlantic seldom hear about the North Atlantic Oscillation, and that can mean harsh years or not. What is the North Atlantic Oscillation, and what does it do?
So the North Atlantic Oscillation, or NAO, as we sometimes call it in short, describes the atmospheric circulation over the North Atlantic, especially in Northern Hemisphere winter, which has important impacts on weather in Europe. So it is measuring the difference in sea level pressure between the Azores Islands and Iceland. A positive North Atlantic oscillation means that the jet stream is very strong in that year and a northward shift of the storm track, leading to more stormy and relatively warm and wet winters in Northern Europe and less stormy and therefore drier winters in Southern Europe. So in contrast, a negative North Atlantic oscillation means a wavier, meandering jet stream leading to the opposite weather patterns. We have increased storminess with warm and wet conditions in Southern Europe, whereas Northern Europe is much colder and drier typically.
And then for listeners in Australia and East Asia, we have a third system called the Indian Ocean Dipole. Could you introduce us to that?
Sure. The Indian Ocean Dipole is, in a way, El Niño's small cousin in the Indian Ocean. So similar to El Niño, it is characterized by changes in tropical sea surface temperatures, but these are occurring in the Indian Ocean instead of the Pacific Ocean. And these, in turn, affect weather patterns in countries surrounding the Indian Ocean. A positive Indian Ocean dipole means that sea surface temperatures in around Indonesia are typically colder than usual, leading to less rainfall in Australia, whereas in contrast, a negative Indian Ocean dipole means that the ocean surface temperatures are much warmer than usual in Indonesia, leading to more rainfall in Australia.
So what did you and your colleagues set out to do in this new study?
So we were analyzing a set of new climate model simulations that have a much higher resolution than most previous climate models, which leads to a better representation of a number of atmospheric and oceanic phenomena, including a more realistic representation of El Niño in that model. So during that analysis, we found that El Niño undergoes a kind of tipping into a very different regime. So in the current climate, El Niño and La Niña events occur relatively irregular and are of moderate strength. We only have extreme El Niño events maybe once a decade or so. But in the model, we see the switch to this very different regime that oscillates very regular between strong El Niño and strong La Niña years in response to greenhouse warming.
So is that why your paper used the most extreme IPCC pathway called SSP 5 to 8.5?
Was actually the first simulation that we had ready to analyze. We are actually now looking at other emission scenarios as well in this new model, and there's an indication that El Niño undergoes this tipping point in these experiments as well. But this is still very much ongoing research, and we hope to say something more definite on this very soon.
Do we know what regulates ocean-to-atmosphere patterns, the kinds we've been talking about? Why is 1 year El Niño and then we get three La Niña years?
Two scientists, one meteorologist, Jacob Bjerknes, and then one oceanographer, Klaus Wirtke, really laid the foundation for understanding of these climate patterns in the late 1960s to early 80s. So the key is that there's a positive feedback between the tropical Pacific Ocean and the atmospheric circulation. Very similar to a loop where an acoustic signal from a loudspeaker gets feedback into a microphone and amplifies. An anomalously warm Pacific Ocean, so-called El Niño, causes the trade winds to weaken, which in turn reduces this upwelling of cooler waters in the eastern Pacific, which in turn leads to the surface ocean to warm even further. So that's what we call this positive feedback. But at the same time, this weakening of the trade winds leads to a change in the ocean currents that transport water in the subsurface ocean up to several hundred meters deep between the tropics and subtropics. So during an El Niño, warm water in the subsurface Pacific Ocean is transported away from the equator, thereby cooling the subsurface ocean and eventually leading to a La Niña event. And it is this transport of warm water away from the equator. This can be very strong, and it can take then several years for it to flow back to the equator. So that's the reason why we often have these multi-year La Niña conditions. And maybe the best way to think of it is as a similar to a recharging and discharging of a battery. So if we have all this excess warm water in the equatorial subsurface ocean, we have the conditions that are set for an El Niño event. However, once an El Niño occurs, the battery discharges, so water flows away from the equator in the subsurface ocean, which then leads to a La Niña. And then it takes several years to recharge this battery again to allow for El Niño conditions to occur again.
What is hydroclimate whiplash?
So this is a term that has been more frequently used in recent years, and it refers to extreme swings between climate conditions. So, for instance, we typically see drought in Australia during El Niño and more rainfall during La Niña. Now, if we have very regular swings between El Niño and La Niña, we would see a constant whiplash between very dry and very wet weather without many years of normal conditions in between. So this is what we call hydroclimate whiplash.
For over 15 years, you published peer-reviewed papers investigating large-scale atmospheric cycles, the kind we've been talking about. Tell us about the resonance developing in global climate modes.
So El Niño is the biggest player, really, in the climate system. As we discussed, the swings between El Niño and La Niña affect weather patterns globally. But there are many other climate patterns that occur as well, such as the aforementioned Indian Ocean Dipole, or the North Atlantic Oscillation. In the current climate, we see some influence of El Niño on these other climate patterns. For instance, the Indian Ocean Dipole occurs quite frequently during El Niño events, while for the North Atlantic Oscillation, this connection with El Niño is currently very weak. But not all Indian Ocean Dipole events in the current climate are caused by El Niño. They occur frequently also independently of what's happening in the Pacific Ocean with El Niño or La Niña. So in our experiments, we see that as El Niño and La Niña become more regular and much stronger as the planet warms due to our greenhouse gas emissions, the impact of El Niño and La Niña on all these other climate phenomena increases significantly. So we can think of these different climate phenomena. In this case, this would be El Niño, the Indian Ocean Dipole, the North Atlantic Oscillation, among others, as different metronomes that are connected to each other by sitting on a wooden plank that can transmit the vibrations between the different metronomes. Now, El Niño has its intrinsic period, which is like a 3 to 7 year oscillation in the current climate. So as different metronomes can synchronize to a common oscillation frequency when they are coupled together, the other climate phenomena can synchronize with El Niño in our model simulations. So what ends up happening is that all the other climate phenomena follow the large and regular swings between El Niño and La Niña, and this is what we call resonance.
European forecasters do not see La Niña or El Niño as primary drivers of weather in Europe. Could that change, and how can we understand the interlocking of systems, how it's going to apply to Europe, for example?
Correct. So while El Niño in the current climate has very strong impacts on countries surrounding the Pacific and Indian Oceans, it does not affect weather over Europe very much. However, in our experiments show that the aforementioned North Atlantic Oscillation synchronizes with El Niño in this warmer climate. That is, it really swings back and forth following the swings of El Niño and La Niña. Thereby, El Niño is then affecting temperatures and rainfall over Europe.
If the model is correct, by 2050 or so, Earth would enter a dangerous new phase of weather patterns that are no longer irregular but more predictable. Tell us about the model your team used, and briefly, how did you cross-check results?
We are using a relatively new climate model, which is among the best performing ones. We also checked all the previous models that were used during the last IPCC assessment, and found that there are a few models that show a similar behavior. However, we cannot yet provide an estimate on how likely this emergence of global resonance really is. So we are really actively working now on the question by examining what the models that show this behavior have in common and what distinguishes them from the models that don't show this behavior.
Could there be advantages to more predictability so governments and people can plan or adapt?
This increased regularity of El Niño, together with the emergence of global resonance between the different climate phenomena, indeed implies higher predictability of regional weather patterns. So the critical question, however, will be if a given region or country will be able to adapt to those regular and frequent swings between local weather extremes, you know, such as the year-to-year swings between droughts and higher than normal rainfall in Australia.
The strongest and most damaging El Niño events were in 1982-83, again in 97 and 98, and most recently in 2015-2016. I would add the weaker El Niño in 2023 because it pushed a record heat that year and following. As we go ahead to 2050, does your model suggest even these past monsters will seem tame compared to much stronger and more damaging El Niños coming regularly?
Yes. It is a rather robust result that as the Earth warms, the hydrological cycle intensifies. And El Niño of the same magnitude as those that you mentioned in 82, 83, 97, 98, and 15, 16 will already cause much more extreme weather swings in a warmer climate. An even stronger El Niño event will further amplify these weather swings.
A theme in your long work is the search for predictability for coming seasons. Why is that important to you and to all of us?
So accurately predicting regional rainfall and temperature for upcoming seasons is critically important for all sectors of society. For instance, it affects decision-making in the agricultural sector, water resource management, and disaster preparedness in general.
So we picture the ocean 30 years from now. It may be hotter all over. Is it possible general ocean warming will overwhelm the El Niño event? For example, a new study finds pan-basin warming now overshadows robust Pacific decadal oscillation. How do you see the relationship between continuing heating and current drivers like El Niño?
The general ocean warming and El Niño events will compound each other. So the natural temperature and rainfall swings associated with an El Nino will occur on top of a much warmer baseline climate, which will then intensify the impacts of El Nino.
A paper 20 years ago by your colleague Axel Timmermann suggested the ENSO cycle reaches, quote, a crossing of a Hopf bifurcation in the mid-21st century. In the new paper, you also found the noise of random weather leans towards a more predictable pattern, possibly around mid-century. Can we think of this bifurcation as a kind of tipping point in large atmospheric systems?
Yes, a Hopf bifurcation is indeed a tipping point at which a system transitions to a very regular oscillation, which is exactly what we find occurring with El Nino in our experiments. So in the current climate, El Nino is highly irregular, occurring maybe every 3 to 7 years. But after this Hopf bifurcation tipping point, it becomes a regular oscillation, always swinging back and forth between El Nino and La Nina without remaining much in so-called normal conditions. Exactly as the aforementioned metronome example.
Is it fair to say a top-level model suggests continuing warming might create a new rhythm in global weather, predictable months ahead or even maybe years ahead?
Yes, that's indeed what our studies so far suggest.
And does your work say that in coming decades we might experience weather more extreme than anything seen so far, or just extremes more often?
So our study suggests that likely both will be the case.
That's not great news. Okay, so once large oceanic systems like ENSO, the North Atlantic Oscillation, the Indian Dipole become coupled, would you suggest this is a permanent change, like a new weather future for Earth?
Yes, this is indeed what our experiments project. However, it is important to emphasize that we as humans will determine what our emissions are going to be, and with that, how much warming and changes in the climate system we will experience. So we are certainly not locked into this possible future.
Suppose this state-of-the-art coupled climate model developed by the Alfred Wegener Institute is correct. What are we risking with continuing emissions if that new weather future turns out to be true?
The capability to adapt to these highly regular weather swings induced by El Nino will differ vastly from region to region, from country to country, and from sector to sector. Certainly exploring potential adaptation pathways is critical for regions that already see strong El Nino or La Nina impacts in the current climate. But pursuing adaptation in regions that so far were largely spared from El Nino's impacts, such as Europe, could potentially be more difficult.
Are you looking for a general theory of weather relativity, so to speak? And what are you working on now?
A lot of research has shown that further improving our understanding of El Nino and its role in the global climate system is key to both improving seasonal climate predictions that we discussed, as well as narrowing down remaining uncertainties in regional climate change projections, such as extreme weather events as the Earth continues to warm. So I would say the overarching goal of my research, as well as the International Pacific Research Center, which I am the director of, is to provide people with the most robust information on climate and weather hazards, and thereby informing both mitigation and adaptation efforts, be it preparing for the next season or the next decades.
From the University of Hawaii at Manoa, we have been speaking with Dr. Malte Stucker. He leads the new paper, Global Climate Mode Resonance Due to Rapidly Intensifying El Nino Southern Oscillation. Find links and more discussion in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Malte, thank you for helping us with this big picture.
Thank you for your time.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
This is a climate emergency. Find out more on the blog. Ecoshock.org. No sign up, just the latest info, free for all. Ecoshock.org.
Europe is warming faster than anywhere else on the planet other than the Arctic. In 2003, a deadly heat wave killed tens of thousands of Europeans. A study by the Barcelona Institute for Global Health found over 60,000 heat-related deaths last year in the summer of 2024. What will it be like when the whole Earth is significantly hotter due to climate change? A new paper in Nature Climate Change investigates increasing risk of mass human heat mortality in Europe. The lead author is Dr. Christopher Callahan from Indiana University and the Dorr School of Sustainability at Stanford. Christopher Callahan, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us about the deadly heat wave in Europe and why it is a focus for climate-driven deaths, that one in 2003.
Yeah, Europe is uniquely vulnerable to the health impacts of extreme heat. It's a place where air conditioning is relatively minimal, at least compared to the United States, and it's a place where the hottest temperatures of the year are rising very rapidly, creating the potential for very deadly conditions. It's also a place where we have already seen very severe heat waves. In August of 2003, there was a very devastating heat wave across France and many other countries in Western Europe, which was really in some ways the first catastrophic heat wave of the climate change era. But now we are seeing similar conditions recur as global temperatures rise, making each additional heat wave more and more dangerous since we're trapping heat in the atmosphere with greenhouse gases.
Well, weather, including heat waves, is notoriously variable. It always has been. How did your group isolate what deaths were caused by weather versus climate change?
Absolutely. We used a machine learning algorithm that had been previously developed by some of our collaborators at Stanford that was able to predict extreme heat conditions in a way that incorporated both the impact of climate change in terms of warming temperatures, as well as the other sort of random variable weather conditions, like how dry the soil is, how intense the heat dome overhead is, and so on. And so we were able to make predictions about future heat waves that said, let's control for all those natural factors. Let's assume the weather variability stays the same, but that in the background, there is this steady march of rising global temperatures. And when you put those two together is when you get really dangerous conditions.
Well, as climate protection seemed to be failing, I mean, emissions are increasing. More scientists warn 3 degrees C of global warming is possible this century. We might pass 2 degrees of warming in a decade or two. What happens, Chris, when a 2003-level heat storm hits Europe again, but in a 3 degree hotter world?
We found that as many as 30,000 people could die across Europe in a single week if the weather conditions that happened in August of 2003 happen again, but the Earth is 3 degrees Celsius warmer than it was in pre-industrial conditions because of human greenhouse gases. This is obviously a staggering death toll. It's close to some of the worst weeks of the COVID pandemic, meaning that it would be associated with significant pressures on the health system and other significant social instabilities.
Okay, but people with means do adapt. A new paper from Christopher Callahan and colleagues found, quote, recent adaptation to heat in France has reduced the projected death tolls of future 2003-like events by more than 75%, end quote. How did you and your 6 co-authors handle expected reduction in deaths as humans adjust and take protective measures?
There's a couple of different things going on here. One is that after the 2003 event, we do see that France is sort of a success story for adaptation to heat. So, for example, they required all nursing homes to have at least one air-conditioned room, which is really important for safeguarding the health of elderly people who are particularly vulnerable. On the other hand, we have not seen comprehensive adaptation to extreme heat spread across Europe in a really universal way. In the more recent paper we published, we showed that if you take existing patterns of adaptation across space and project them into the future to assume that people adapt at the same pace they are now, we would reduce the future death toll of these events by about 10%. That doesn't mean that adaptation is useless, because it could be accelerated. It's just that we have to make the choice to accelerate it rather than simply assuming that it will occur on its own.
So you think future heat waves will overwhelm adaptation even in wealthy countries in Europe?
I think it depends on the policy choices made by those countries. If countries make significant investments in expanding air conditioning, creating heat action plans, creating public cooling centers, doing outreach to vulnerable and isolated people, these are all techniques that we know can reduce the death toll of heat events. But they are choices that have to be made by policymakers, and right now we're seeing major fights even in domestic politics in some European countries, about how heavily to invest in air conditioning. So ultimately, it's not a foregone conclusion that these countries will be able to successfully adapt.
Plus, then we have a minor problem that heat waves also stress power plants, and so the grid can go down and the AC doesn't work. And there you have people who have expectations that they're safe, and suddenly they're not.
That's absolutely correct. A really dangerous situation for an extreme heat event would be the reduction in electricity availability or overall blackouts as the grid is stressed. Luckily, one of the same investments, renewable energy, that reduces carbon emissions, also creates resilience to extreme heat events. Solar panels are extremely effective when it's hot out and the sun is shining, much more so than thermal power plants like gas or coal, which require cooling from water and from nearby rivers, which we've seen be vulnerable in previous heat waves. So we have the opportunity to mitigate some of these risks, but it's a choice that we have to make.
Currently in Europe, extreme cold is supposed to cause 8 to 10 times more deaths than extreme heat. But how do you see that balance? Is it changing? Now heat's the big threat and not cold?
One of the things that researchers, including myself and my collaborators right now, are still trying to figure out is what is the relative danger of extreme cold versus extreme heat conditions. It does appear that overall, cold conditions are responsible for more deaths than hot conditions, and this is mostly because in places like the United States and Europe, we experience a lot of very cold conditions in much of the winters that we have. That said, we know that climate change is causing increases in temperature year-round, and so in the future, we can certainly expect more and more heat-related deaths, irrespective of how many deaths are also caused by cold.
So there is another outlier, and it's being talked about more and more. If the Atlantic meridional overturning circulation weakens or fails, then the warm tropical waters stop coming to the UK and northern Europe. Surely that would greatly change any projections and maybe bring back cold rather than heat again.
Yeah, changes in the Atlantic circulation are a significant uncertainty in what the future climate holds, especially for Europe. I'm not an expert in that circulation, so I'm not going to speculate about details, but I can say that if that circulation were to slow down or fail entirely, there would be significant alterations to many different weather patterns in Europe.
One other minor factor on this program, Dr. Camilo Mora from the University of Hawaii told us extreme heat causes organ damage that can show up in deaths up to a year or more later. So there may be a long tail to extreme heat waves and deaths. Did your study take delayed deaths into account?
We only looked at deaths during the week of the heat and the several weeks after. So if it is possible that heat causes damage or injury that might recur, you know, months or years later, that would only raise the total death toll that we anticipate, but it wasn't directly considered in our study.
Also on Radio EcoShock, Greek scientist Matt Santamouris said the threshold temperature for excess mortality differs. For example, in his native Athens, the danger line is close to 32.5 degrees C, 90 Fahrenheit. People there are adapted to high temperatures, but in London, it's much, much lower when people start to show up in emergency wards. Did your study account for this, and are expectations for mass heat deaths different in southern and northern Europe?
Yes, that's absolutely correct. Our study did account for this, where we were able to assess how different locations are vulnerable to different levels of temperature, depending on how adapted they have been historically. So we do see that in colder places, like in northern Europe, it takes less of a heat wave to cause the same death as in southern Europe, because places in northern Europe are less well adapted to those extreme conditions. That said, exactly where the most extreme death toll would occur depends on the location of the heat itself, which sort of depends upon the weather variability. But what we can say is that in general, the same heat wave with the same temperature will end up being more dangerous to people who are living in relatively cold places than people who are living in relatively warm places.
That's so counterintuitive, but it's good to know.
Yeah, absolutely. In the United States, for example, if you think about a heat wave hitting Seattle versus Houston, places in Houston or Texas have a lot more air conditioning than places that typically don't need it.
Well, yes. In the 2021 heat dome here in the Vancouver area in British Columbia, we lost 600 people because there's no air conditioning and no prior experience of that kind of heat.
Absolutely. That 2021 event in particular was one of the most extreme heat events ever witnessed on the planet. Unfortunately, we can expect more of that as global temperatures warm.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Alex returns with Dr. Chris Callahan on heat deaths in Europe.
Many European countries have aging populations, including France, Germany, Italy, and Spain. What does that mean as more extreme heat arrives?
Typically, we observe that the people that are victims of extreme heat events tend to be elderly people. These are people with potentially more pre-existing health problems or who may be more vulnerable to extreme conditions in general. Our study didn't explicitly consider how different age groups are affected differently. In general, though, there is good evidence that as populations age, we do get more and more vulnerability to heat.
According to a 2024 study by Kai Chen and colleagues, heat deaths double when global mean temperature goes from 1.5 degrees to 2 degrees C of warming, and getting 2 degrees seems pretty likely, and then with growing emissions, 3 degrees C of warming is possible by the end of this century or before, and at 3 degrees of warming, they found deaths are 5 times higher than current heat waves at 1.5 degrees. Does that fit in with your findings, and is global warming kind of a threat multiplier?
I think it is correct to call it a threat multiplier. One thing that we see is that the relationship between heat exposure and mortality risk is nonlinear, meaning every additional degree creates greater and greater risk. The hotter you are, the more each additional degree creates additional exposure and impacts. And so the more we see temperatures rise, the more we should expect each additional increase in greenhouse gas emissions to be more and more dangerous.
Why do you say even 4 degrees C of global warming is plausible if we try gradual decarbonization? That surprised me a bit.
I think it's important to clarify that in general, in this study, we're looking at global temperatures on an annual basis, not a long-term basis. So in general, the current prediction is that we are likely to end up at around 2.8 degrees Celsius of global warming by the end of the century if current emissions policies are maintained. What previous evidence has shown is that if you end up in a climate that's around 2.8 degrees Celsius, you can have additional individual years that are potentially warmer than 3 degrees Celsius because of the sort of random variability of year-to-year temperatures. So I do not think it is particularly likely that we get an individual year that is 4 degrees Celsius warmer than pre-industrial conditions, but even if we don't end up in a 4 degrees Celsius climate, it's still possible to have individual 4 degrees Celsius years.
What if weather becomes more stabilized in a warming world, perhaps as the oceans get more stable and they heat up relatively evenly, so we don't get an event like the 2003 heat wave in Europe, or at least not in this century? Is that plausible?
It's definitely possible that climate change will alter atmospheric circulation and weather patterns in pretty complex ways. This is still an ongoing active area of research, and I don't think we have a clear scientific consensus on this yet. And in fact, our study didn't really look at this question. The only question we were asking was, if these weather patterns recur, what would be their effects? But it's certainly important for the scientific community to figure out if it is possible for them to occur. But the uncertainty on that projection right now is extremely high.
And work by Noah Diffenbaugh and Elizabeth Barnes suggests global warming will drive even more extreme heat waves beyond anything seen in recorded history. What do you think, Chris?
I think that extreme heat is one of the signal impacts of climate change. We know with near absolute certainty that every degree of global warming gives us increases in the intensity and frequency of extreme heat events. And so as long as we continue emitting greenhouse gases, we should expect these extreme heat waves to continue getting more frequent and more intense.
It sounds to me like more and more of people's time and the global economy will be devoted just to surviving the changes in heat. We try to keep the civilization going during hotter and longer lasting heat waves. Does your research convince you heat survival will become a basic preoccupation in coming decades?
I think it depends on who you are looking at. I do think that heat survival will be a central concern for lower income people and people who have to work outside. If you are an outdoor worker, a farm worker, someone who works in the open air in some way, you absolutely need to be worried about how you're going to manage your exposure to very hot conditions during the summer. Absolutely.
Chris, take a little time and tell us, what are you working on now?
I'm interested in thinking about the future risk of similar extreme heat events and how we might use our statistical tools to analyze those future events if they occur beyond anything we've currently experienced. We might see extreme heat events that are in any individual region worse than anything that individual region has experienced historically. And so how do we analyze and understand those events given that much of our understanding of climate change is based on our historical experience? So I'm really interested in this tension between needing to prepare for future unprecedented extreme events and the difficulties that those unprecedented events pose for both social and scientific systems.
From the Paul H. O'Neill School of Public and Environmental Affairs at Indiana University, we've been speaking with Dr. Chris Callahan. He leads the article, Increasing Risk of Mass Human Heat Mortality of Historical Weather Patterns Record. And it was published November 18th in Nature Climate Change. You can check it out. I'll put links in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Chris, thank you for this.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Yes, yes.
Light taker.
Oh, yeah.
Empty out.
Everything.
Got a mortgage on my heart. Got me stumbling from the start. Storm maker, heartbreaker. Parents of the underworld promising the dawn.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Are you getting less freezing and more heat stress? How does that affect your energy bill? A new technique analyzing hourly weather reveals a lot about this. The team combed through 46 years of American weather records to find critical changes. Dr. Sandra Uter used her 30 years of experience with meteorological hardware and big data dumps to find trends in a lot of weather records. Sandra has her PhD in atmospheric sciences. She is distinguished professor of environmental analytics at North Carolina State University. From Raleigh, North Carolina, Sandra Uter, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hey, Alex. Pleasure to be here.
There are all kinds of record keeping for daily temperatures. We see that all the time. What inspired your team to look deeper into the details of the hours?
So the reason why a lot of the climate information that we get is based on daily information is that most of the record only has daily temperatures. So that's the minimum and maximum and sometimes the average. It's only been in the last few decades, so since about the late 1970s, and in the U.S., we routinely recorded hourly observations. There were a few stations that had some hourly observations actually back to the 40s and 50s, but not too many. And so I guess there was a couple of motivations for this. One was when I talked to kind of the general public, my neighbors, I have students in a freshman class, and I tell them, temperatures are going up by 1 to 2 degrees Celsius. They pretty much sort of shrug and say, it doesn't seem like a big deal to me. But yet, if you've lived in a place for a while, you've probably noticed that things have been changing, but you can't quite articulate it. And so we thought that by looking at the hourly data, that we could sort of dig deeper and get better information about a couple of key thresholds that actually matter to people. So, for example, if it's 15 degrees Celsius, let's say that's about 59 degrees Fahrenheit, and, you know, the temperature goes up by 2 degrees to 17 Celsius or 62.6, you probably wouldn't even notice much. But if you cross a temperature threshold, like if you were below freezing and now you're above freezing, or if this 30 degrees Celsius temperature threshold, which is 86 Fahrenheit, is the threshold for heat stress where you really start feeling the physical effects. Those are noticeable, impactful thresholds. And so we thought by looking at the hourly data, we'd get a much better picture of those changes associated with those thresholds.
Yeah, this is the way humans experience weather. We don't experience a daily average. We're going through it hour by hour. And I love your list of ways weather can significantly shift in just an hour. Can you give us some examples?
One that I think most people will resonate with is if a thunderstorm goes through. So say it's like a very hot day in the summer, and then a thunderstorm goes through, right? It gets more cloudy. Often there's rainfall, which then cools the temperatures. And so within a matter of minutes, the temperatures could drop. So this makes a big difference in terms of energy usage and comfort. So for example, if that thunderstorm happens in the middle of the afternoon, where it's already been pretty hot, and now we've sort of got this couple of degree temperature relief, that's a big deal because in terms of the energy use. But if that same storm goes through in the middle of the night, you're less likely to notice it, and it's not going to make such a difference for energy use.
Weather records seem to self-define into three large regional groups in the continental U.S., according to your study. Could you introduce us to those regions and maybe a little bit of what sets them apart?
Basically, we've got, you could almost divide the U.S. into thirds, sort of the western portion, so west of the Rocky Mountains, then the middle portion, and then the eastern portion, which would be sort of the Mississippi to the coast. And so what we're seeing is different climate trends in these threshold temperatures based on the areas. So in the East Coast, particularly the Northeast, the bigger changes in climate have actually been in winter. And I think we don't hear about it so much on the news because if there's, you know, a bit more warm spells, right, nobody's going to the hospital. People are just like, okay, well, maybe I don't need such a heavy coat. But we've actually seen more changes in the winter than in the summer. And that's in terms of the number of hours below freezing. So we're essentially losing winter faster than we're getting changes in the summer. So in the, particularly the Northeast U.S., we've lost about 1.5 to 2 weeks equivalent of temperatures below freezing. And so this makes a big difference in terms of whether we're getting rain or snow at the surface. It obviously makes a big difference if you own a ski resort or trying to go skiing. It also makes a big difference for things like invasive insects because they, you know, when it's cold and freezing, that sort of helps mitigate their spread. In the West, and particularly the Southwest, we're seeing more changes in terms of higher temperatures. Those temperatures where we're above that heat stress threshold of 30 degrees Celsius or 86 degrees Fahrenheit. And then in the middle, it's actually quite interesting because there aren't clear trends. Instead, what there is a lot of variability. So I think understanding these differences, I mean, the U.S. is a big country. It's not surprising there are differences. You know, right, everybody's familiar, there's a huge difference in the climate between Florida and North Dakota. But understanding how this then affects people's decisions about how to adapt. The problem with the Midwest is without a clear trend, you can get a lot of different outcomes year to year. And that's harder to adapt to than if, for example, you're knowing that you're going to have a lot more hotter temperatures in the summer, or if you're going to have sort of milder winters in the East Coast.
I wonder if that variability leads to people in the Midwest being less sure that climate change is happening because they don't experience it as directly as, say, somebody in New England who can't get any ice rinks to freeze anymore because their winter's too warm. They know something's different.
Yeah, I think this is a really good point, and I've actually been wondering about it myself. I think here, like in North Carolina, I was talking to a colleague, and he was saying about his 90-year-old neighbor was talking about how they used to skate on a pond in a nearby park. And, like, for us, that's, like, unthinkable. That would never happen. But, again, if you're in the Midwest and, like, some years it is quite cold, frigid, and other years it's warmer, I think, yeah, it's, as I said, it's related to the lived experience. And so your lived experience, if you're in the Midwest, is, well, it just all seems very variable, you know, and I think it's harder for them to necessarily see because where they're not experiencing it.
The data used in this study is truly solid. It comes from 340 stations with continuous reporting from 1978 to 2023. But the measurements do come from airports, though. Does that matter? Could it miss even hotter temperatures deep in cities?
I guess the airports matter for a couple of reasons. One is, if you think about from the late 1970s till now, a lot of urban areas have expanded. So when a lot of these airports were built, they were kind of probably on the outskirts of cities, and now they're probably closer or maybe even, you know, incorporated into the built-up areas. And so there is a bit of an urban heat island effect, which would tend to make the temperatures a bit warmer than, say, the surrounding rural areas. But our thinking in the paper was that this is part of what people experience. We are not only seeing the outcomes of changes in temperature due to increased greenhouse gases, but we're also seeing changes in temperature associated with building out of asphalt and buildings and replacing, you know, more green and forested areas with more built up. And so in terms of, again, what people actually experience, that's part of it.
You also captured data from Canadian weather records, at least in southern Canada. What did you find out about changes in freezing or heat for our Canadian listeners?
So basically the general patterns in terms of the Midwest and the more southern central Canada versus more eastern Canada, those patterns are similar to what we see in the U.S. with, again, a lack of trends more in the Great Lakes areas. And then as we move further east, a more clear trend about losing time with temperatures below 0 degrees C.
And your group found hourly temperature trends can reflect in energy use. I found that very interesting. You find most of the U.S. encounters fewer hours needing heating in winter, but more cooling degree hours in summer. Does that winter warming savings cancel out energy demand in summer for air conditioning?
So it depends on the region. So in the northern parts of the U.S. and in southern Canada, because of the more warm spells in the winter, we're actually saving energy, and that savings is more than the additional cost of the higher temperatures in the summer. If we go to the western U.S. and the southwestern U.S., it's reversed in the sense that we are spending more money to cool on those hot days, and that the warming in the winter is not enough to offset it. So it sort of depends. It's a regional thing. And again, in the Midwest, it's variable. And so if you're in a utility, this is a problem in the sense that you have to anticipate a wider range of temperatures and energy use. Whereas in the northern part of the U.S., you can anticipate that your energy load is going to be less in the winter.
Sandra Uter, your team found a lot of different possible applications for hourly weather trends. Can you give us some examples of who can use this?
Well, I think there's a variety of groups of people. I mean, one of our sort of key, hopefully, people that would take this information is state, local governments, even businesses, in terms of what would they do to adapt for changes in the next 10 to 20 years. Because often the resources are limited, so you want to prioritize. Also, do you want to invest a lot of money in shade for, let's say, your city center? Those, I would argue that, you know, particularly in the Southwest and the West, that's a high priority. It may not be such a high priority in places like the Northeast, because while it does happen on some days, it's less of an issue. Also, if you are in the agricultural sector, I think, and you're worried about your livestock outside, you know, again, are you going to invest in cooling in the summer, or are you going to invest, you know, does it make sense? Are you worried about, like, the warming of your farm animal sheds? And then also things like, again, invasive insects. What are those risks? So I think particularly here on the East Coast with less cold winters, invasive insects are more of a concern.
I wonder if this technique of hourly approaches could be expanded to some other fields. For example, flash floods and sudden torrential rainfall seem to have increased in recent decades. Do you think that could hold promise with your technique?
I think it's different with flooding because often we're looking at an accumulation of hourly rain. So if I particularly look at when we had the very bad Hurricane Helene here last fall in North Carolina, a lot of the reason why those rivers flooded so quickly was because there was a storm before Hurricane Helene came that had already made the ground quite wet and already raised the levels of the river. And so then Helene on top of that really was, you know, led to extraordinarily bad flooding. It's different with precipitation because you're sort of building up the flow, the stream level in the rivers over multiple hours and multiple days, rather than having like a very heavy rain in 1 hour.
Although we have heard of some very heavy rains in 1 or 2 hours, a foot, recently happened in Vietnam, as a matter of fact. So how can this new hourly view help communicate the reality and direction of climate change to the public?
Basically, by focusing on thresholds that have clear impacts, like freezing and heat stress, we're basically helping people understand impacts that will matter to them personally in terms of their day-to-day activities and the infrastructure that they use. And I think it's just easier to relate to than just sort of a general, oh, the temperatures are going up by 2 degrees. Because when you hear 2 degrees, you know, I think people just, you know, kind of shrug and say, yeah, it doesn't seem like a big deal to me. So you want to be thinking about it in terms of when you cross these key thresholds and what the impacts are.
So you got your doctorate in 1996, but you appear to have co-authored a paper in 1981. Did I get that right? And if so, how did that happen? How did you get going as a young scientist?
So I was very fortunate as an undergraduate working with James Head at Brown University in planetary geology. Yeah, this was actually one of the key experiences in my life that led me to be a scientist, is that I was able to get a summer job in his laboratory working with data related to the topographic features on the planet Venus. So he was funded by NASA to use this data from a new satellite, and I participated in the data analysis. And my contribution was sufficient that the other professors who were on the paper basically decided that yeah, it was worthy of a co-authorship.
And now, after a lot of peer-reviewed studies you've authored or co-authored, and some are very technical, what are you working on these days, Sandra?
We're working on a number of different things, but one of the things that I'm actually most excited about is we're trying to get a better understanding of cloud dissipation. So as in atmospheric science, we have a pretty good idea about why clouds form, but we're not so good at the sort of end of the life cycle, about exactly what is the time scale and processes associated when clouds go away. And so we've developed some new instrumentation to help us study this at relatively, so at time scales of a few minutes, and spatial scales of tens of meters to kind of fill in some gaps of our understanding. Most of our data on clouds right now comes from satellite, and so it's a bit coarse, usually multiple kilometers, and often we don't, you know, depending on the satellite, the time scale could be minutes, hours to days between the different pictures. The other problem with satellite is that because it's looking down on the Earth, if there's multiple levels of a cloud, then it only sees the topmost one. And so we've developed some ground-based instrumentation to look at low clouds, so basically looking upwards. And so this is giving us some new insights into how these low clouds form and then how they dissipate. And as you might anticipate, this has big implications for things like solar energy. When a cloud goes over a solar insolation, the amount of solar energy that comes in drops, and it actually can drop over periods of minutes, so it can be very variable. So, and also it's related to things like, you know, the surface temperature. So that's some of the stuff that we're working on right now.
I've probably talked to 24 scientists who said clouds are the last real frontier of unknown, and they can determine what kind of climate future we're going to experience, whether we get more clouds and when we get them and where they form. So I think you're working on something really important there.
Okay, well, thanks. I appreciate that. Yeah, we're often trying to figure out where the gaps are and where I particularly focus on observations, where new observations can help us fill in those gaps.
From North Carolina State University, we've been speaking with distinguished Professor Sandra Uter. Find links and notes to all the science we just talked about in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Sandra, thank you for spending time with our listeners.
Well, it's been a pleasure, Alex. Thank you so much.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Record-setting typhoons and atmospheric rivers are directly due to ocean heating in a greenhouse world and the vapor-loaded warmer air. Very large systems are changing. A study published last February found extreme precipitation in southern China shot up 10 times previous amounts over the previous decade. That is astounding and very hard on people in China. I ask you to become global citizens. Look beyond the news filter to see big changes going on in the real world. The oceans and atmosphere are all connected to your own weather, economy, and society. There is no other side of the world. Just one small planet, your planet. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring. Let's meet up again next week.
Now for something completely different.
When the screen cracks, nature shapeshifts, gradual violence building into superstorms and fire. Quick, find shelter in your love. This universe, they say, all of it and everything is contained in a black hole. The infinite has limits. When it all twists out of shape, court houses and palaces sinking into the ground we left void. Quick, find shelter in your love. When it all goes crazy as a part, how can I not? New flexible rulers shrink and grow, no way to measure anything to geolocate where I stand. Go on. Set your mind to standard time, but minutes are shorter now. Hours longer, days uncertain, faulty artificial thought, misdirected into lives in shallow sounding. The ship of state runs aground, citizen witness to the passing of something great. Nuclear razors hiding underneath vainglorious struggles, earth predators past the peak, past the funeral wire, still joy.
Joy
is ready to surprise. Life in the cloud. Quick, find shelter in your love.